Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Zone War by John Conroe, narrated by James Patrick Cronin. Chapter 1. And now for today's edition of Zone War. Viewers are warned that this presentation may include sudden images of extreme graphic violence, including death. This production is unscripted and carried live in unedited format for an authentic viewing experience. Under no circumstances should any viewer attempt to enter the Manhattan Drone Zone without explicit authorization by the Department of Zone Defense Exclusion Authority. All of the salvage and bounty personnel depicted are duly licensed and trained professionals. There are no amateurs in Zone War, and Flottercott Productions is not liable for any injuries or deaths incurred by viewers of this program. In other words, do not try this yourself. Of course, I had to cross the living room at that exact moment, my bowl of ice cream balanced on my work tablet. I had timed my foray into the kitchen with exacting precision, determined to be in and out in under 2 minutes, which was the amount of time till that blasted show started. The rest of my family was huddled around the viewing wall in anticipation of the daily showing of what was currently the most popular reality show in the world. Not being able to find the ice cream scoop had foiled my plan. The screen melted from the skyline background with floating words to a live feed showing bouncing footage of one of downtown Manhattan's deserted streets, husks of cars littered about, a stoplight lying on the road. The sun was out, and the camera mounted on the outside of the light-armored vehicle was broadcasting a clear, high-def picture, even if it was shaky from the vehicle's ride. Catching the opening scene was my first piece of bad luck. The second was Monique catching sight of me in the corner of her eye.
"Hey, AJ's here. You gonna watch it with us this time? Or hide in your room?"
"I'm going to work in my room, little sister, so that we can get paid for what I brought out yesterday," I said. The little sister part was ill-advised on my part, as it was guaranteed to trigger her twin's temper. Gabby whipped around on the couch and glared at me.
"Oh, is Big Brother busy saving the day?"
14-year-old girls should come with the same kind of hazardous warning labels used for explosives and poisons. I'd rather face the zone any day than get drawn into a verbal war with my lethal little sisters, who fire off words faster than a Russian wolf anti-personnel drone fires fletchets.
"Gabby, enough. Ajaya's work is important to this family, and you know it. All of our BUIs together aren't enough to support us, even with your father's death benefit,"
my mother said, shutting down the more volatile of the twins. Then she turned my way.
"And you, Ajaya Edward Gurung, how many times have I warned you about arrogance?"
"I wasn't being arrogant, Mom. I was making the point that I have other things to do besides watch that crap, especially when I can see it in person any day I want, if I want to take the risk of being near them," I said, moderating my tone. Behind my mother, the terrible twins both raised their hands and enacted individual ceremonial displays of the middle finger. Monique chose to pull off the imaginary top of her middle finger lipstick and apply a liberal dose to her lips, while Gabrielle blew into her thumb to inflate her own middle digit. My eyes flicked their way and then back to my mother, whose face had taken on her stoic look, the one where she tries not to crumble for fear of my weekly forays into what was regularly described by the Zone War narrator as the most dangerous place on Earth. And it was. Take the island of Manhattan, release over 25,000 highly advanced Russian, Chinese, and Indian autonomous war drones in a single stunning act of terrorism, and let simmer for 10 years. The result was the one borough of New York City that was completely devoid of human inhabitants and whose artificially intelligent denizens aggressively kept it that way. It was estimated that over 372,000 people lost their lives in the first week of the Manhattan attack. Another 23,000 died during the second week as rescue operations and military units counterattacked. Only a crazy fast response by U.S. Special Operations Ready Reaction Teams in coordination with New York National Guard, FBI, NYPD, and a whole alphabet of other federal groups kept the drones from escaping into the other four boroughs. The whole world almost died as an enraged America brought the doomsday clock to 11:59:59, saved by uncharacteristic transparency on the part of Russia, India, and China,
who all stepped up to provide assistance and data about their drone weapon systems, and particularly against the terrorists. 10 years later, the terrorists who were responsible, the Gaia Group, were completely obliterated, hunted with a chilling ruthlessness by a fiercely unified United States. The Burrow Island, however, was still a no-man's land, and a rich one at that. Everyone in Manhattan either fled or died in not much more than a few days' time. One of the wealthiest communities on Earth became empty so fast that countless riches, both literal and information-based, were left lying around for anyone to pick up. Anyone who could get safely past the lethal new owners, that is. Hence Zone War, a show that followed 5 salvage teams as they braved the Zone on a regular basis to kill drones and pull out abandoned riches. The Zone was also the source of my income. The money that kept my family afloat after Wall Street crashed, was abandoned, then relocated piecemeal to backup sites around the East Coast. The massive worldwide recession that followed dwarfed all others before it. 10 years later, the world economy was just now starting to see the sprouts of fiscal recovery. Yes, we all received the basic universal income checks that were paid out to all Americans, but that wasn't enough to do more than cover bare necessities, as Mom had said. Zone War was a huge success, a show that followed the flashiest and noisiest salvage teams, and none of them made more noise than Johnson Recovery. "Oh, Ajaya, there is your girl," Amma said from her spot between my sisters. My father's mother is quite the romantic. Both of my sisters turned and gave me their best smirks. I ignored them, but I couldn't quite bring myself to ignore the monitor. On screen, the camera had switched to the face of the LAV driver, the blonde, blue-eyed Scandinavian goddess of the drone hunt, Astrid Johnson. The youngest member of Johnson Recovery, a.k.a. Team Johnson, Astrid was the principal LAV driver, but also filled the role of Overwatch sharpshooter when more than 2 of the team deployed from their armored vehicle. A beautiful, smart, and very tough girl, she was hugely popular across the nation, and probably most of the globe. A role model for girls and an object of fantasy for guys of all ages. I've known her since we were both 10. Only her oldest brother, JJ, was as popular. Tall, muscular, and bold, JJ was the JR point man for ground deployments, and his media nickname was Thor, possibly because of the big sledgehammer he used to break into buildings, possibly because of his blonde good looks. Women sure seemed to dig him. You had to give him his due. Even with full body armor, he took enormous risks every time he stepped foot on Manhattan soil, mostly due to his father's preferred approach to things. Drive fast and loud, shoot everything in sight, and then haul ass back out at extreme speed. Right on cue, the camera view switched to show JJ crouching with his father, Brad, just behind the driver's seat. Brad Johnson, or Colonel Brad Johnson, was ex-U.S. Army. He'd started his career in tanks, then moved into a Stryker Brigade combat team, and never looked back. He and the rest of his family were in Manhattan visiting an old military friend on the night the drones were released. They escaped, as did their host family. Drone Night was a life-changing event for anyone who survived it, and Brad Johnson was as affected as anyone, maybe more so. Within a year, Brad had quit the military and the Johnsons had relocated to Brooklyn. Brad started Zone salvage work even as the military was still permanently blockading the island. He started work with his military friend, an ex-British SAS sniper named Babaram Gurung, my father. Eventually, they had a falling out over work methods and went their separate ways. I turned away from the show and walked out of the room, down the hall and into my bedroom, which is also my office. Time to make some money. Chapter 2. Status, I asked.
Current bids on items 1 through 10, 12, and 14 are all below reserve level, my personal AI reported. Items 11, 13, and 15 have been purchased for the buy-now price.
Time left on remaining items?
14 hours and 7 minutes.
There are almost as many ways to make money in the zone as there are ways to die. Almost. The most common is salvage.
The New York State court system ruled that anything found and recovered inside the exclusion zone was the property of the finder. Federal circuit court cases backed that decision. Finders keepers was the law of the zone, and Manhattan was chock full of stuff to find, from cash, gems, jewelry, art, furniture, fashion items, and electronics, to corporate secrets and proprietary information on standalone computer systems, all abandoned in the attack. The Johnson family had proven to be experts at monetizing the zone. Initially, Brad and my father had brought out cash that they recovered from stores and banks. Nowadays, the JR team just went in hell-bent for leather, raided an art gallery, jewelers, or even an haute fashion store, and bulled their way back out. Only licensed recovery agents were allowed onto the island, but the Johnsons also acted as guides, highly paid ones, for rich people who wanted to experience shooting a Chinese Raptor drone or firing a 50-caliber anti-material rifle into a Tiger ground unit. Then there were the massive studio fees paid to the on-air talent that made Zone War the top show on the globe. Yes, the other teams contributed to the popularity, but the attractive Scandinavian war family was top draw. If you don't believe me, just count the ads you see, some or all of them in, hawking everything from the latest workout clothes to Astrid's own line of makeup for combat to JJ's signature basketball shoes. As wealthy as they had become, the JR team's approach to salvage left a lot to be desired, especially if you wanted a really tricky recovery, like, say, corporate intellectual property left on the 22nd floor of a downtown high-rise. Their bull-in-a-china-shop approach stirred up every drone in a half-mile radius, leaving them with just a handful of minutes to extract their valuables before the sheer numbers would overwhelm even their heavily armored vehicles. That's where I came in. Gurung Extraction had a sterling reputation for bringing back hard-to-recover items. That's because I'm stealthy AF. Slip in and slip out. Part training by my sniper dad and part tech magic of my own design. The things I was selling on the Zonite auction site were just extra, mostly jewelry that I found along my way. We also had the beginnings of a pretty good family bank account going, the result of stashing any and all cash picked up during my Zone travels. That was going to pay the twins' way through college, but the real money came from specific recovery missions.
You have 3 new queries for services?
Summarize, please. For some reason, I was always polite with AI. Most people weren't. It just seemed right somehow.
1 is a request for choice items for sports memorabilia housed in a private collection in the Upper West Side. The 2nd for recovery of legal papers from a personal residence. And the 3rd is a corporate query for proprietary software in a Wall Street trading office.
Triage, please.
The corporate request is the only one that meets or exceeds your risk-reward minimum offer. The sports request is not remotely rewarding enough, and the stated offer for the legal papers is far below the corporate query. Additionally, there is a time-adjusted bonus for the recovery of the computer records.
Display. The one blank wall in my room lit up with the email, including 2 financial numbers, the main offer and the bonus, each of which were large enough to make me set my ice cream aside. Somebody really wanted their algorithms. Which immediately begged the question as to why now, 10 years later. Actually, reading the email all the way through answered that question, or at least provided an answer. Zone recovery rates of success have not been deemed sufficient until now to attempt salvage, I read out loud. Somebody's been paying attention to Gurung Extraction, I mused. The corporate name on the email was something called the Zeus Global Finance Corporation.
Correct. ISP addresses assigned to Zeus Global Finance began viewing the Gurung Extraction website 2 weeks ago. Additional bot searches on the web have left sufficient evidence to indicate a relatively deep review of Gurung assignments to date.
I thought about the offer, then reread the few details of the extraction that were listed. Did Zeus Global have an office on Wall Street?
Negative. However, the Zeus website lists 2 corporate executive officers who were employed by a different firm, now defunct, that did have offices near Wall Street 10 years ago.
The wall view changed to list the two officers as the chief investment officer and chief financial officer, complete with pictures, as well as a side-by-side map of Lower Manhattan with a building highlighted in yellow, located on Broadway about a block from Wall Street. "Add in known salvage team activity for today's date and tomorrow," I instructed. The map on the wall suddenly showed three new highlights in red, green, and blue, respectively. There were currently five teams on Zone Wars, and one of the government's stipulations regarding the show was complete disclosure of each team's daily location plans. Independent salvage people like myself did not have to disclose any information other than designating our chosen zone entry point and our intended egress site. Proposed trip duration was also collected, but that was just so the zone defense people could alert our primary contacts if we went overdue. That was it. Nobody would be coming in after us if we didn't come out on our own. During its 4 years of production, Zone War had followed a total of 12 teams. Seven of them had either died or quit the business during that time. The actual number of salvage people lost in the zone was currently at 162. The survival rate was so low that the production company only occasionally picked new teams, and only from people with several years of experience. Myself, I had close to 8 years of experience, most of it with my father. After Brad and J.J. Johnson, I was probably the most experienced salvager out there. Flottercott Productions had approached me exactly 3 times to be on the show, once a year for 3 years running, but much to the dismay of my sisters, I had turned them down all 3 times. No way was I allowing a drone camera to follow me around, giving away all my secrets, and there wasn't a camera team anywhere that could survive accompanying me, even if I was to ever give permission. I personally doubted any of them were stupid enough to try. My longevity in the world's deadliest job was directly due to my highly personalized approach and my very customized technology. Inform the sender that I agree to attempt the extraction, strike any guarantee clauses and disclosure amendments, I instructed my AI. Done, it replied. Okay, now we need to get down to planning. My father was huge on planning. Massive time was spent on every aspect of a recovery before we ever set foot in the zone. No detail too small. I could quote every drone's specifications forward and backward by the time I was 12. Nowadays, 2 years after his death, I have an exhaustive data bank of information built up in my AI's drives. My planning is still just as thorough, just generally a whole lot faster. First, we reviewed current satellite footage of the building's neighborhood on Broadway, then pulled blueprints on the building itself from the NYC Department of Buildings database. The laptop in question was thought to be on the 17th floor, which was gonna be a bitch. Better than the 37th floor, which the building had, but still, dragging myself, my stealth suit, and my gear up 17 flights of stairs was gonna suck. Hard. Suggest carrying cutting torch, bolt cutters, and titanium pry bar. The state of the building is completely unknown. No record of other recoveries occurring at that address. Great. My AI was right, of course. Getting in and out of multi-story buildings could and often did require serious abilities to break and enter. All of my gear was miniaturized, but my pack weight and the resulting suck factor went up with every ounce. I'll go through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel entrance, I decided. Concur. That will place you far from the Chelsea Pier entrance. Johnson Recovery and Igorov Salvage are both scheduled for entrance to the zone at that point tomorrow. Diversion rate is estimated to be 64.8%. Diversion rate was my own proprietary measure calculated by my AI using satellite footage, Zone War production crew drone counts, and my own drone counts measured at the same time if I happened to be in the zone. I got the idea watching one of the few full episodes I had ever sat through. At some point during the episode, I realized that someone or some AI on the studio team kept a running tally of observed drones at the bottom of the screen. The producers used it to raise the viewing tension, as the number would race higher the longer a team was in the zone and the more noise they made. I myself kept a running count of any and all combat units that I observed during my forays, along with the time observed. After egress, I would give that information, along with details on which models and makes I had seen, to my AI. 25,000 was the estimated number of drones released in the attack, an entire ship's hold's worth. Since that time, thousands had been killed or damaged in the course of the passing years and the active action of the salvage crews. The U.S. government paid a hefty bounty for every unit that could be confirmed destroyed, with varying payouts depending on the sophistication and danger each unit posed. Also, Air Force render drones hunted the high altitudes, preying on any visible drones, and marksman units on barricade duty sniped as many drones as they could see. There were a couple of mothership drones that had onboard 3D printers that could make small replacement drones, but otherwise the number was estimated to be dwindling, perhaps as low as 15,000 drones remaining. Unfortunately, the most lethal and sophisticated units that were the best at killing humans were also best at avoiding their own destruction. The bounty for an Indian tiger hunter killer was north of $200,000, and forget about one of the three remaining Chinese Spider C-3 units thought to be at large. Each command, control, and communication master drone could orchestrate up to 300 lesser drones at a time. They had been the most highly advanced units in the Chinese arsenal at the time of the attack, equipped with real progressive machine learning software that was capable of rewriting itself to adapt to the battlefield. One Spider had been destroyed at the end of the second week of the Manhattan attack. That single unit had coordinated battle drones that killed an estimated 230 soldiers, cops, and federal agents. The fact that three such units were still unaccounted for was likely the main reason the military hadn't gone back into Manhattan in force. So the bounty on a Spider C-3 was approaching $1 million. Cheap, if you ask me. You might wonder if we didn't have more advanced drones now, 10 years later, that could go in and fight the battles without human lives being lost. We do, and it didn't work. The C-3s kept learning, kept adapting, kept growing. They beat the more advanced drones sent against them. In fact, the information in their CPUs, the software that they wrote and rewrote over 10 years, would be worth, in my estimation, closer to $1 billion. Every army on Earth would pay up for it. Some people wonder if any of the C-3s are still active, still functioning. I can personally vouch for two. Scariest moment of my life. 18 months ago, in the north end of Central Park, I use the park often, as the drones tend to stay in the more urban areas, not because they don't function well in the park, but because the park is full of deer and coyotes and a small number of animals that escaped the Central Park Zoo. Combat drones are designed and programmed for killing humans. They ignore animals. But having that many warm bodies clouding their thermal senses is confusing to most drones, costly in processing power. So they tend to stay out of the park, which makes the park one of my favorite places. Anyway, I was skirting through the woods and came upon the edge of the old softball fields. It was a really nice, sunny summer day, and I sensed motion out on the overgrown field. Dad's lessons kept me deep in the shadows, peeking over a small hummock of rock and dirt, my low thermal signature camouflage hood over my head. Through my monocular, I saw a veritable army of drones, motionless, solar collectors spread out for maximum charging value. Right in the middle of 4 tank killers, 7 tigers, about 20 Russian wolves, and a veritable flock of various flying units were 2 C-3s sitting in the open, charging batteries like the rest. The C-3s look like their nickname, spiders, black-painted armored spiders, each the size of a sofa loveseat, except these spiders have 7 legs, not 8. The horde stayed that way for an hour, then suddenly the entire battle group of drones activated all at once and flew, crawled, or rolled off to the east, leaving me in a pile of sweat and maybe a little urine. Maybe more than a little. I bring out dead drones fairly regularly, but mostly just small ones, or I yank the CPUs and ID plates from bigger ones. I don't have a heavy electro-powered hybrid LAV to haul my catches, so my paid kills are kinda low. My actual tagged kill numbers are a different story.
The zone is my real office, and salvage my work. And work is good. Tomorrow, I'd head into the Manhattan drone zone. Chapter 3. I inserted the next day, calling for an Ublift car to transport me and my gear to the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. Self-drivers aren't allowed in the tunnel, only military or salvage company vehicles, and they have to be manually driven ones at that. Catching a ride with a zone military driver that I knew, I tried going over my plan as I rode. Fat chance. My driver turned out to be quite a chatty Cathy.
"Yo, Gunga Din, what you got going today?"
Corporal Lynx asked. I had quoted the final line of the old Kipling poem once to him, and since that day, he'd called me Gunga Din. Ignorant bastard didn't even know that the fictional Gunga was Indian, while I'm Nepali-American. "You know, just thought I'd go skipping around Wall Street and find some old stock certificates I can forge my name on," I said.
"You can do that?"
he asked, brows raised, looking at me and not the road.
"Nobody has used certificates in decades,"
I said, shaking my head and pointing at the left-hand tunnel wall that we were about to slam into.
"Oh, not spilling your real deal, huh?"
he said, swerving back to center.
"You don't trust me,"
he stated, now pissy.
"Confidentiality agreements in my contracts. My clients don't want me giving out any of their secrets,"
I said, which was true. I wouldn't have told him anyway. OPSEC, operational security. Dad was huge on that one. Any mission information you gave out would travel faster than a bullet and could be just as deadly. Lynx kept silent, not speaking for the rest of the trip, which was fine with me. We arrived at the zone checkpoint, Battery Park, which actually lies under the park in what used to be the old Battery Underpass. Lynx let me off before taking his load of supplies to the zone quartermaster. I thanked him, but he just gave me a nod and drove away. I know for a fact that a lot of the zone guards collect under-the-table money from reporters about any juicy salvage gossip, and Corporal Lynx was definitely one of them. The fact that I didn't give away much of anything informational was a sore point for him, like I was shorting him his additional pay. Never mind that it was part and parcel of my zone protocol, and one that helped keep me alive. Soldiers, like all people, talk, and often by phone. Drones can hear phones. Nuff said.
"Ah, Mr. Gurung, what brings you to our little slice of heaven here in the battery?"
the entrance sergeant asked, holding out his hand for my pack.
"You know, Sergeant Alonzo, just looking for my personal pot of gold. Heard the rainbow came down on the other side of those steel doors,"
I said as I carefully watched him give my gear a casual but professional once-over. Weapons, ammo, first aid, breaking and entering gear, distraction devices, booby-trap gear, food and water. But no commo gear and no batteries. That was the rule unless you were going in as part of a team, and then only on an armored vehicle. Even the military special forces units that use the zone for training went commo-free. Most Manhattanites lost their lives during the attack because they lacked all the right instincts. Modern humans were both totally reliant on electronics and so self-absorbed by them that they missed the danger cues all around them. They completely failed to react usefully to the drone threat, or, once they realized it, called their own doom down upon themselves with those same phones. I've seen hundreds of bodies of people who died looking at their cell phones, which everyone seemed to have back then, before personal AIs. Many people died because they ran over each other, blocked up escape routes, or simply froze in place. People often failed each other as the veneer of civilization was ripped away, and it became every man or woman for themselves. The majority of people tried to shelter in place. Then they called for help on those damned phones. Instead of rescue, they called the drones right to them. Even when the military tried overflights with speakers announcing to any survivors to leave their phones and attempt escape on their own, most still tried to call for help. Combat drones were built by humans to kill humans, and they built them very well. Almost every model in the invasion group had the capacity to detect and track electromagnetic signals. Most could find ways into buildings, open doors, or hack electronic locks and alarms.
and drones generally work in swarms or at least pairs. One would bang on the door while a flyer would drop down and shoot you through the window. So, we weren't supposed to bring electronic stuff in.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?